welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Dave Waldron. The author Olive Schreiner once wrote, "I know there will be spring, as surely as the birds know it when they see above the snow two tiny quivering green leaves." Well, despite all the late snow we've had, we are finally in the throes of spring, and if you're listening, you can hear the birds telling us so. Today's Hometown Alaska is all about birds and the part we sometimes play in their lives. Human interaction with birds is typically limited to us watching our bird feeders, but occasionally a more intimate role is needed. We'll be talking with some bird experts to start the show, and then later in the program, we will be bringing a crow into the studio. But first off, we're going to start with two members of the Bird and Treatment Learning Center, or as they're better known in town, Bird TLC. We have Laura Atwood, who is their executive director, and Katie Thorman, who is their rehabilitation assistant. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So Laura, can you give us a quick history of Bird TLC and what it is the group does?
Sure. So Bird TLC started all the way back in 1988, actually. And that was started by Dr. James Scott in his veterinary clinic. He realized there was a need for care for wild birds who were injured, ill, or orphaned. So he started caring for them in his clinic. And it just grew from there exponentially. So after the clinic, then we were in two different rental locations, and then finally able to move onto our own property and rehabilitation clinic in 2018. And that's located right above Potter Marsh. I think most people know where that is. So we all have a truly amazing view of Potter Marsh all day, which is pretty incredible. So that's where we are now. And we care for, well, last year we cared for just over 550 birds that came to us from all across the state of Alaska.
And it can't be a coincidence that Potter Marsh was your location of choice, because as people that live around Anchorage know, that is a very popular mm-hmm. birding spot.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, we look out over Potter Marsh. We get to watch a nesting pair of bald eagles. We get to see ravens all day. It's pretty amazing.
And how did you get involved with the group? Are you a birder yourself, or do you have just a passion for birds?
Of course, yeah. We all love birds. I will admit, I am not an expert birder. Bird identification is difficult for me, but I admire birds and their adaptability and the way they survive the conditions up here, the cold winters, the ones who choose to stay here through the winters. It's pretty incredible, their adaptations. But for me, a lot of it comes down to, since we do rehabilitation of injured, ill, and orphaned birds, in most cases, what caused them to come to our clinic was human-caused. Not always intentionally. It can be inadvertently. But it is a way to give back to something that we may have made happen. And like I said, that's not always intentional. It can be a window strike because we have so many homes with large windows. It could be hit by a car. There are the occasional intentional things that happen. We have, I believe, two eagles. Katie can correct me. Two eagles in right now who were both shot. So we do have times where it was an intentional harm to the bird. So to have that privilege to correct that and to minimize the suffering of an animal is really important to me personally, as well as to everybody who works at our clinic. And then the other part of our mission is education. So reaching out, especially to young kids, and introducing them to the natural world through our ambassador birds, and hoping that what that translates to is to them caring about the bird's habitat and about our natural world as they grow up into adults.
What about you, Katie? How'd you get involved?
So I've had a very nonlinear path to becoming a rehabilitation assistant. I actually moved to Alaska about 3 years ago from Savannah, Georgia, and I got my start rehabilitating small mammals, so raccoons, squirrels, possums, all those fun kind of lower 48 species that we don't have up here. Mm-hmm. When I moved here, you know, I just Googled wildlife rehabilitation. Bird TLC is the only one here. So I hadn't thought much about rehabbing birds. I always enjoyed birds. I grew up watching them at my grandma's feeder. I did bird camp as a kid in my hometown in Mansfield. And after, I think, two or three shifts at Bird TLC, I was kind of all in and hooked. My personal favorite are, of course, our raptors, but we treat such a wide range of species at Bird TLC that it's easy to just kind of dive in and find your passion there. So, yeah, didn't start out wanting to do birds, but I couldn't imagine anything else right now. So,
how does Alaska's birds stack up to the Georgia birds?
It's definitely a different dynamic. I lived in Savannah for almost 5 years, and of course we had ospreys, bald eagles. We had a lot more shorebirds and more kind of songbird kind of vibe too. But up here, it's such a rich range of raptors, songbirds, shorebirds. You get a little bit of everything up here in Alaska.
Laura, in some ways, Bird TLC is kind of like a zoo mixed with an EMT service, right? You got, on one hand, you're responding to these injured birds and you're wanting to nurse mm-hmm. them back to health. But for the birds that can't be released, you house them at your building and you offer these educational opportunities to the public. Is that kind of sum it up what you're trying to do?
I like that, EMT services. I'm going to steal that from you, just so you know. Okay. I am not above that. Like, to give you an example, Katie will be picking up some eagles later today who are being flown in from the Aleutians. We have two eagles headed our way today. So yes, definitely very much EMT services. But yeah, that does sum it up. We're here to provide that veterinary care that and also to provide the education through our ambassador birds. Right now, we are not set up in a zoo in the sense that people can't come to our property to see the birds. We are hoping to get there in the future. Mm-hmm. But right now, our birds do go out to schools, any organization actually who wants to call us and say, hey, come do a bird program for us. We'll be there, guys. Just get on our website and see what we have to offer.
So what does decide the birds going to you as opposed to like the zoo? Because the Alaska Zoo has birds there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, who makes those decisions to where these birds go?
Yeah, well, we are a licensed rehabilitator. The zoo does not do rehabilitation. So we've actually gone to the zoo before when they've had birds in trouble there, when they've had wild birds. What did we have, Katie? One time there was
A raven a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. I want to say a bald eagle sometime last summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, mostly smaller
and
birds.
And a swallow.
We did have a swallow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we'll go out there to help them with a wild bird that gets itself into some trouble at the zoo. And then we are the licensed rehabilitator. And then in terms of if a bird becomes an ambassador bird, then there's a lot of factors that go into that. And a lot of that is, does it seem like this bird will be comfortable living under human care? Because the last thing that you want is a bird who is not happy living under human care and living, being exposed to humans day after day. But truly, our first goal, our main goal, is to get them back into the wild. That's where they were born. That's where they belong. And we're only going to make a decision about keeping a bird as an ambassador if for some reason they can't be released into the wild.
That seems like a really hard balance to have between you're going to go back into the wild, ideally, but if you're not ready for that, we're going to take you to a classroom full of children. Like, I mean, right. how do you balance that role for these birds?
Yeah, well, so things have been changing a bit in the industry. When you look at our collection, we have some birds who, our eagle Kulak is 20 years old, right? So we have some who have been with us a very long time. And a lot of the older birds, they stayed on because they had injuries that prevented them from going back into the wild. Things have changed. The thinking has changed. And what any zoo or education center like us is trying to keep is birds who are imprinted, meaning they came into human care so young that they don't really know they're a bird, or they're habituated, which they know they're a bird, but they're comfortable around people. So keeping them not so much because of their injury, because that can potentially be uncomfortable for them throughout their lives, but keeping birds who are emotionally and mentally comfortable being around humans, so that going into a school or coming to your studio is not stressful for them.
The eagles that are injured, Katie, what happened to them, the ones that you're going to get later today?
You know, I'm actually not sure. I just got the message, hey, you might have to go pick up eagles later today. I believe one is a suspected broken wing, or it was found and the wing was kind of, you can tell sometimes if it's broken or there is a wing injury if it's kind of drooping off the side. Nice thing about rehabilitating birds is they're very symmetrical. So if there is something along those lines wrong, you can kind of diagnose from a picture before the bird actually comes to you. So I think it's a suspected wing injury on one, and the other, I'm not sure. I'll find out when I pick it up from the airport.
Well, that must be really exciting to just, you're going to get some eagles and you don't know what the next step is, essentially, right? I mean,
right, yeah. So how it'll work is, you know, I'll go to the airport. I get to be the cool person that says, I'm here for the eagle, and put it in my car.
Got the shades on.
Right. I do have special shades I wear to pickups. So we'll take it back to the clinic, and myself and our veterinarian that I work primarily with, we'll probably, sometime today, sometimes we do it the next day, because obviously it's a wild eagle and a carrier who's had to just go on a 2-3 hour flight, and they've probably been in a carrier for a little while anyway. That's already pretty stressful. So sometimes, depending on what it is, we might give them overnight to just kind of decompress and just kind of sit in a quiet, dark space. But after that, we'll give them a full physical exam, check on probably that target spot that was probably the reason they were brought in the first place, and go from there.
What is the most typical bird injury you see? I've got to guess what it is, but
sometimes depends on the bird. What I see a lot are broken wings and window strikes. And then in the summer, vehicle strikes. What was your guess?
It was window strikes.
Window strikes, and, yep.
You know,
good guess.
And I've been meaning to ask. I feel really irresponsible. I mean, every year I have at least 2 to 3 birds that smack into my window. Mm-hmm. And every time except this last bird, they get up, they're stunned for a moment, and then mm-hmm. they fly off. But this, unfortunately, this last one that hit my window last summer was a robin, and it mm-hmm. died. Mm-hmm. So what can people do to kind of, I feel like there's something like deflectors they can put on their windows. Or
Yeah, there's special, I mean, you can find all kinds of stuff online. I've fallen down several window strike rabbit holes. There are special, you know, window clings you can put up. There's cool ways you can do tape on your windows to form kind of a grid so that the bird sees it. There's certain colors, I think, that some species of bird pick up better than others. So anything, and even sometimes just having your blind shut or tilted a certain way to make it very clear. I was actually doing some research on window strikes recently because I do a bi-monthly newsletter for our volunteers. One of the main reasons they hit windows are, you know, depending on if they're migrating day or night, but they're finding a phenomenon with people having plants inside. So the bird sees the plants through the window and they think, oh, I can go land on that. And they end up colliding with the window. So, like I said, tape, window clings. There's really cool, like, stained glass window clings you can put up now that just make it vibrant enough to where they know, okay, that's not something I can fly through.
So with a window hit, I'm guessing that the best course of action is to do nothing normally and let the bird regain its wits and then hopefully fly off, right? Or should we be doing something?
Yes and no. You know, it's interesting you say that because I was able to release it yesterday, but we had a saw-whet owl. I don't know if you know what they look like, but they're very cute. They're about a robin size. And he was being chased by magpies. He got chased into a window, smacked into it. The lady thought somebody threw a rock at her window because he smacked so hard. And just like you said, her first course of action was, I'm just going to leave him alone and he'll get up and fly off. He was being harassed by the magpies, so he must have disturbed or disrupted something, but they kept coming back and striking and striking, so she thought, he's going to get picked apart, I better go out and get him. If it's a situation like that, you know, scoop him up, you can give us a call, and we'll take it from there. With some smaller songbirds, the best course of action is, you know, to just give them a minute. They're teensy tiny, it's very hard to be a songbird, and to just kind of let them recuperate. And what I usually will advise people is let them sit for a couple hours, because sometimes when you're that small and you hit something that hard, it's going to take you a little bit of time to get your wits about you. But if they don't fly off and it's been 6 hours, then it's like, okay, I can put them. Some people will do kind of like an open paper bag and the bird can sit in there. And then when it's completely with it again, it can fly off. Or that's usually when they give us a call and they can bring us the bird and we can take it from there.
So if they do find a bird like in the wild, say, and a bird is injured, should they try and bring the bird out of the wild, or should they just call you?
It's another one of those situational things, you know. There's never, it's the interesting part of rehab is sometimes there's a clear, direct answer, and other times it's like, I don't know. You know, we had a raven brought to us last week that people found him on a trailhead and his wing was dragging and he can't fly away. He can hop really well, but he's not flighted. So that's a situation where it's like, okay, if you can catch it, because sometimes that can be tough too, bring it to us and we can assess the situation. If it's something where the bird is flighted and can flap away, one, I'm not going to be able to catch it because if they can fly, best of luck. But, you know, it's one of those, well, should we take it or should we let nature take its course? And something like that, I say, let nature be nature. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We are very careful when we ask them to maybe try to get the bird. Because depending on the bird and the size of the bird, it can be dangerous to you. Even a raven, you would not believe how strong those beaks are. Mm-hmm. So if we do give people instructions, we're very clear about what they should do and how they should do it. But rarely do we advise that anybody try to get something as large as an eagle, for instance.
Never.
That's something, you know, just give us the information and we'll take it from there. So I just caution people. We love our Good Samaritans because that's how the majority of the birds come to us, right? You know, we're not out there driving around seeing all of these injured birds. So they're the ones who are out there helping, taking time out of their lives and bringing them to us. But we do caution you to definitely give us a call before you try to get anything larger than a songbird.
Please call.
Yes, please call us.
What about invasive birds? I don't want to sound mean, but you know, we have these certain invasive birds.
Right.
Should we let nature take its course with these birds that are kind of hurting our ecosystem?
I will give you a disclaimer. If it's an invasive species like a pigeon or a starling, per our permit, you can bring it to us, and that's great. And it could either be injured or perfectly healthy. Because it's an invasive species, we have to euthanize it.
So
I'm going to jump in here real quickly and just explain. We are permitted by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Alaska Fish and Game.
Right.
And those permits lay out very clearly what we can and can't do. Mm-hmm. So as Katie said, invasive species, we are not allowed to rehabilitate. We could lose our permit if we did that.
Yeah. So it's not me saying, oh, I don't want this pigeon or this starling. It's genuinely a permitting thing.
Sure.
That's not to say if it were up to me, would I or wouldn't I? Probably not, because it's an invasive species. But yeah, it's a fish and wildlife, fish and game issue.
What is your favorite thing about working with birds?
It's like we were talking about, they have so much going on that people don't realize. We see them every day in our backyard, right? They become kind of commonplace. And until you start working with them and learning from the experts about how smart they are, all their adaptations, the journeys that the migratory birds make, I mean, those little songbirds that come back in the spring, when you start learning how far they've flown, it's, you know, it's pretty incredible. So you get a new respect for these animals, definitely.
What about you, Katie?
Yeah, it's pretty similar to what Laura just said. One of my favorite things is just there's something very special about taking something and watching it fly again. You know, it's always, releases are always kind of bittersweet, but, you know, you spend all this time and care at literal bird TLC, you know, getting it healthy again. And then that moment when it flies out of its carrier or whatever, you know, we brought it in to be released and a lot of the birds take kind of a moment to take it all in that they can fly away. And watching them kind of figure out, oh, like I can just go again, it's very moving.
Is it hard to not get attached to these birds? Like, I mean,
I get asked this a lot. There, for me personally, there's a couple where I've been, you know, you can't keep them. If they're fully flighted and they're wild, it's the best for the bird. But I can think of at least one where I was just a little misty-eyed as she flew off and into the great beyond. So,
which one?
So we took 2 bald eagles to Haines, Alaska to release them this past November. One of them came to us 4th of July. She was a baby bald eagle. She was probably about a month old. So by the time we got her, she came from Yakutat and was flown up to us. And so she was basically my whole life last summer. And it was just really exciting. You know, it's exciting to have this baby bald eagle and you are watching her grow and hit all these benchmarks and progress. And we had to work really, really hard to make sure she didn't imprint on us and stay wild. So, you know, you go through that whole process. I watched her, you know, start to perch and start to dig into salmon and, you know, do all these really great wild bald eagle behaviors. I'm pretty sure I got to see her take her first flight when we took her out to our flight building, and that's pretty magical. And then watching her learn to land and do, you know, like a full length back and forth in our flight pen. So releasing her down in Haines, I'm like, this is the best possible spot. I know she's set up for success, but it was kind of hard to watch her go, for sure, because I, you know, we don't band our birds right now, so I have no idea after she leaves. We've put in all this effort and hard work. I always joke when I release a bird, I'm like, goodbye, hope I never see you again. Not because I don't want to, but that means you're out in the world living your best bird life. And with her, it's like, I hope I never see you again, but I also hope you're out living your best eagle life. So,
to touch on why we went all the way to Haines.
Oh, yeah, that's probably worth
to release two bald eagles. So in the winter there, part of the river stays open. It doesn't freeze. So the fish, the salmon keep running all winter. So there's always a congregation of hundreds of bald eagles in Haines throughout the winter. And the American Bald Eagle Foundation, they have a bald eagle festival every November. And when we have eagles that are ready for release, as part of our partnership with them, we go over to Haines to release them. In this case, it was perfect for these two young eagles that we had because they hadn't been taught how to be eagles. So they needed to be released somewhere where they were surrounded by adult eagles. So that's why Katie and I flew to Haines to release them there.
When I was searching for a good springtime quote that was synonymous with birds to start off the show, I found one that was kind of hilarious. I'll read it to you. Every year, back comes spring with nasty little birds yapping their fool's heads off and the ground all mucked up with plants. So I always think of like bird songs as something that everyone enjoys. Have you met people or heard complaints of residents that just don't like birds? They don't want them around and they're like calling to complain to you. This was author Dorothy Parker, by the way, in case you're wondering
who wrote that. My goodness.
Dorothy Parker, she does not like birds.
What I found interesting is recently there was actually a study done that hearing bird song like puts people in a better mood. So I think that's, she's on the other end of the spectrum. But yeah, I would say there are probably people who don't like, no offense to our corvids, who we love dearly, but who don't like some of the louder corvids. Magpies are loud. And if you happen to have a magpie family in your yard, like we do almost every spring, those babies pretty much don't stop. And I can imagine somebody who doesn't appreciate birds gets frustrated with that. Stellar's jays are probably another one that people don't appreciate their call.
And even bald eagles in certain parts of Alaska are seen as a nuisance.
Yeah.
Have you ever fielded a call about a nuisance bird?
Nuisance in terms of just, I don't want this bird in my yard anymore.
Like there's a nest near my house and it's causing like a bunch of noise.
We did get a call a couple of weeks ago about a magpie nest. And it was in a spot where I think people had to go in and out of a doorway. And then the magpies were dive bombing the people. And yeah, they were upset.
Okay, well, enough silliness, I suppose. I want to thank Laura Atwood, who is the Executive Director for the Bird Treatment and Learning Center, and Katie Thorman, who is their Rehabilitation Assistant. Thank you both for being with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up, we're going to meet one of the Bird TLC's ambassadors and their handler. I'm Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Well, everybody's heard about the bird.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. Today we're talking about birds with the group Bird TLC, which stands for the Bird Treatment and Learning Center. And right now we have Shondell Cotter, who is their education and behavior curator, and her friend Gertie in the studio with us. Shondell, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you to Gertie. Can you tell us a little bit about Gertie the bird?
Yeah, absolutely. So Gertie is an American crow, and she is about 11 years old. She came into our facility when she was about a year old, found on the side of the road. Unfortunately, she had a wing injury that couldn't be repaired. You know, like we talked about earlier, our main job, our main goal is to get all the birds back out into the wild where they belong. But sometimes we do have a bird that would not be able to go back out into the wild for various reasons. For her, it was a wing injury. And so she became part of our ambassador collection. So she has a really important job. She travels around Alaska and goes to schools and other events and teaches people about how amazing crows are.
Well, her job seems really cool, but so does yours. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved with Bird TLC.
Absolutely. So I have been a volunteer for Bird TLC since I moved back to Alaska. I was born and raised here out in one of the villages called Port Allsworth on near Lake Iliamna on Lake Clark. And I went away to chase my dreams of becoming an animal trainer. So I spent a decade down in the lower 48 doing just that, working with all sorts of different kinds of animals. And when I came back about 9 years ago, I just really wanted to get involved with animals up here in Alaska. So I found the Bird Treatment and Learning Center and thought, hey, this would be an awesome place to volunteer. And pretty quickly found that I really connected with the corvids. So, and that is what Gertie is. She's part of the group called the Clever Corvids. They're a group that includes ravens, jays, magpies, super, super smart animals. And so Gertie was becoming an ambassador, and I got involved there, fell in love with her, and never left. And a couple of years ago, we decided to revamp our training program for all of our birds. And I was asked to come on at that time and take over the training program. So I have a pretty cool job working with our 10 ambassador birds at Bird TLC.
Okay. And she's pretty talkative. Normally, she might have a little stage fright right now. Would it help if we got her out of her cage?
She is pretty talkative, yes. So I'm going to go ahead and let her out.
All right.
And I'm sure at some point she's going to have a lot to say to us.
Oh, yeah. She just walks right out, doesn't she? And it doesn't hurt that you have some oatmeal? Peanut butter? What is that you're feeding
her? I wish she loved oatmeal. This is actually, these are waxworms and mealworms.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, but it's a little less dirty than cut-up mice, so we do those often. We'll see if we can get her to talk to us a bit. It might take her to warm up. Call. She's thinking about it. I think she's going to give us some chats here in a minute. Ready, call? Good girl. Gertie. That's not that one. Can you go? Hi. What are you doing? What are you doing? Hi. Hi. Can you do some of your other noises? Can you go? That's not it. She tends to do this one because it was the first noise she learned. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of her go-to, like, very solid. You're silly.
So what are these different commands that you're trying to get Gertie to do? You've got the caw, I got that one.
Yeah. So Gertie is trained to do some different vocals on cue so that when we do education programs, we can talk about communication. That's a huge part of being a corvid, is being able to communicate really, really well. So one of the noises that you heard there when I'm asking her to call is actually the noise that they do an alarm call. So that's to tell everyone else that there is something dangerous or potentially dangerous around. And she is trained to do that when asked. It actually sounds very different when she does it, when she actually thinks that there is something dangerous around. Her body language changes, and even the sound of the noise is different. So that's one of them. The other one that she was doing when I was getting down kind of close to her is purring. And that's sort of an affectionate noise. It's one that she just makes when she's happy and content, and to her people, to the people that she's very comfortable with. So that's called a purr. But we do a lot of training with these guys. So they're trained to step on scales when we ask them to, so we can get their body weights. She can go into her crate when she's asked to. She's actually even learning how to shut her own door and open her own crate door.
Wow.
We work on nail trims with them. And the biggest thing with all of them, because obviously she didn't go into radio studios and schools before she came to be with us, we just want her to really enjoy every program that she's doing, all of our birds. We want them to be super duper comfortable and to have a lot of fun when they're doing programs, so that it's something that they want to keep doing, and not something that they're forced to do. So because of that kind of training, we're able to come into a booth like this that she's never been in, and you know, within just a couple minutes she's acting like she owns the place and is comfortable and checking out the mic. So all things that she's never seen before, but she, I can tell by her body language, her relaxed body language that she's giving me, and even that fluffing her feathers up, that's called rousing. That's something they only do when they're very, very comfortable. And so by watching her and the body language she's giving me and telling me, she's telling me she's having a good time. She feels safe. She feels comfortable.
That's very cool. I didn't realize that birds purr. How common is this? Is this a crow thing?
This is a crow thing. Oh. Yep. A lot of them might have, you know, different noises that they make that signal, you know, affection or being very comfortable. But this is a crow thing. So, and it's pretty special. It's good. We use a lot of, you know, positive reinforcement, telling them good job and giving them treats and whatnot. And that's kind of my positive reinforcement. When she tells me she's happy and safe, I'm like, awesome. Mm-hmm. Let's keep doing this. It makes me feel really awesome about what we're doing with these birds.
I always get this mixed up. Ravens are all crows, right? Not all crows are ravens, but ravens are all crows, right?
No, so they actually belong to the same family, and that is probably one of the biggest questions we get with her, is what is the difference between a raven and a crow? Mm-hmm. So they're both part of the corvid family, but the big blackbirds that we have here in Anchorage, those are going to be ravens. They're going to be much larger than the crows we have here in Alaska. They have different noises that they make, so different calls that they make. When you watch them fly, the ravens can soar. The crows need to flap their wings the whole time. The ravens are going to have a big, thick beak. And yeah, there's just some differences there. But they are in the same family, so they do look similar. And our ravens and crows here, there's a pretty big difference between the two. In the lower 48, they tend to be more similar in size. But our ravens here are huge. So
they are, yeah.
So it's a pretty big size difference.
And they're usually eating like McDonald's out of the parking lot, not this very nice
right?
meal you've prepared for her.
Yes, they're all scavengers. They definitely are opportunistic feeders. So they'll take whatever they can get. And a lot of times it seems like they have learned that from humans is an easy meal. So hanging out in the Costco parking lot or other places like that, they find easy meals here.
Oh, what would Gertie typically be eating if she was in the wild?
So these guys, they'll eat a little bit of everything. They'll eat rodents. A lot of times the crows that we have here are going to be found near larger bodies of water. So they'll eat, you know, mollusks and that sort of thing that you find there. They'll eat insects, fruits, vegetables, literally anything. They have a pretty diverse palate.
And what are some of the other birds you work with? I know you've got a lot of birds over there at Bird TLC. So what are some of the other ones you got there?
Yeah, so we have different ambassador birds in our collection. We have snowy owls, eagles, a red-tailed hawk, a peregrine falcon, and a short-eared owl as well. And then Gertie actually has a roommate, a chatty little magpie who would be all over everything, pulling off your keys on the keyboard and pooping everywhere and just kind of all over the place. So she's hanging out at home today. She's fully flighted. She came in as a very young magpie that we think somebody might have taken out of a nest or picked up if she fell out of a nest. And unfortunately, sometimes we have birds that come in so young, they don't know how to be a bird. So again, we do our very best to try to get them with other birds of their same species to learn how to be a bird and get them back out in the wild. But for this little girl, it was very obvious that after we tried all of our rehab techniques, she was not turning back into a bird. So she lives with Gertie, and the two of them make a wonderful pair. They're kind of like sisters. It's really fun to watch them interact with each other.
And sorry, the magpie's name is?
The magpie, her name is Shavila, which is a Dena'ina Athabascan word for rainbow.
Right, and Shavila was, we kind of mentioned it earlier, was supposed to come in originally, and then we thought maybe she'd be a little too rambunctious. So Gertie's kind of like the ambassador, and Shavila is more like the mosh pit bird.
yeah, exactly. Right. And she is going into some schools and doing some things. She's still learning, and she's doing a great job, but she definitely has a different vibe than Miss Gertie.
Even though Shavila wasn't able to make it today, we do have some great audio of her chatting. So let's take a quick listen to that. Wow. So I've heard a lot of magpies in my life, but I've never heard one say hi to me before. So how typical is that for a magpie to talk like that?
So all the corvids actually can mimic. And so because, again, Shavila came in so young, she didn't learn how to talk from other magpies. So she does have magpie calls that she makes, but she also mimics noises around her that she hears. So the oh hi is kind of my greeting I do to them every morning. Oh, hi, girls. So she picked up the oh hi pretty quickly. She says, how are you doing? Come here. What are you doing? Wow. And one of my favorites is she has picked up some of the dog barking that she has heard. So she can mimic a chihuahua like nothing else. She's heard some of that out in the neighborhoods. So she has all sorts of fun noises that she can do. She actually makes crow noises as well because she has learned those from Gertie. So it's pretty fun. Gertie here, because she was a little bit older, she doesn't mimic any of human noises. All of her noises are crow noises that she had learned before she came into human care.
You said that you were drawn to them. What about them draws you to them?
Most of my career, I worked with mammals, all sorts of different kinds of mammals, and I tend to really be drawn to the ones that are feisty, that really make you think a lot. One of my favorite animals in the world is a coati. It's a member of the raccoon family. They're just crazy smart and sneaky, and you just kind of always have to be on your toes. And when I started working with the corvids, it was very similar. They're always a couple steps ahead of you, so you have to just be constantly, you know, changing what you're going to do to keep up with them, and just being able to build that relationship with them was just so amazing. The fact that this bird, you know, was a wild bird that had unfortunate circumstances which brought her into human care, and that we've been able to build this kind of trust and partnership, and it's amazing.
How do you get these birds to trust you? I mean, you're handling them in a way that a human isn't normally handling a bird. So how do you build that trust?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We really work hard to not only build relationship, but to use the science of animal training as well and work those together. So really spending time with the birds in a really positive way. So our interactions are positive, and so the birds learn to trust us. So things like giving them their favorite food, interacting them in a way where if they are needing space, we give them that space. So one of the biggest things that we teach all of our birds, one of the first things that I teach all of the birds, is how to say no, how to say, I don't want to do that right now. And they know when they tell me, I don't want to do that right now, that my response will be, okay, you can choose to say no. And once they learn that they can say no, they don't use it very often because they know we're not going to put them in situations where they feel uncomfortable or unsafe. So it's a long, slow process, a lot of relationship building, a lot of giving favorite foods, favorite toys, just being, you know, in their space with them without doing anything scary or threatening, and really just consistency in relationship and in our interactions, so that, again, if we bring them somewhere new and different, they're like, okay, you've done so many other things. When I see something new and different, instead of being scary, like, it's an opportunity for all the fun things, for new toys, you know, for treats, for bath time, for, you know, all of their favorite things. Instead of something that can be looked at as scary, it becomes like an exciting new opportunity for them.
Sounds a lot like parenting, what you just described. Like, almost
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Except for bath times. You get that even if you're good or bad, right? What is a typical day like for you dealing with birds?
All right. So a typical day for me when I'm working with the birds is going to be doing, you know, my morning checks, making sure everybody is bright and healthy and alert and good in their enclosures, preparing diets. So we cut up a lot of rats and mice to feed to our ambassador collection. And then as far as feeding, we're doing training sessions throughout the day. So visiting each of the ambassador birds and working on particular goals. Some of them are at the point where they're working on going into the kennel comfortably. Others are at the point where they're learning how to do nail trims, you know, without restraint. So they're kind of in different stages depending on the bird. And then programs. I get to do a lot of programs, which is awesome. I get to go into schools and libraries and community events and present to kids about the different birds and about what we can do to help the birds out here in our area. And then we even do on-site programs in the summer as well. And this summer, I'm super excited for the first time we're going to have a teen volunteer crew so that they can start learning about how to care for animals and see if maybe this is a career path that they would choose. It was the sort of thing that I would have loved and needed as a kid, and it wasn't available. So we're really excited to be able to offer that to kids here in our community. To be able to come in and volunteer and learn how to do education with live animals and how to take care of birds. It's pretty cool.
What are some of the kids' reactions when they get to see these birds up close?
We have had some awesome reactions. We have everything from laughter to awe. And I think some of the adult reactions are actually maybe more excited than even some of the kids. Mm-hmm. Katie and myself just did a program a couple weeks ago where we had an adult sitting in for a long time, and she said, "I don't like birds." And this was amazing. Like, I just had no idea they had so much personality and they were so interactive, and just commented on being able to see a bird the way we were presenting, where they could showcase their behavior and it wasn't someone with just a bird tied to their arm, or, you know, that the bird wasn't showing behavior and showing some of the cool things that it could do. So that's really what, you know, what we're going for, is we want people to love and appreciate the birds, and our ambassadors represent those wild counterparts so that they want to go out and help the wild birds and be like, you know, that raven that I used to think was just a pest, like, I got to see a cousin of the raven today and see how cool and smart they are. Okay, maybe that raven is pretty cool too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just since we've been sitting here talking, I've noticed, you know, when you see a bird in the wild, it's just such a short, fleeting moment and you don't get to really observe them for very long. But since we've been hanging out for a while, I've been watching Gertie and she's been doing all kinds of neat stuff. Like, she leaned kind of on one foot and then like stretched her wing out and then like scratched her wing with her foot, uh-huh. Which I thought was really cool. A lot of fluffing and then all these noises that I didn't even know that a crow makes. And is that the purr we're hearing right now?
That is the purr. She okay. is a, you know, she hasn't made as much noise as she does at a lot of programs. I think she maybe she wants to apply for a job here. She is very comfortable, and all those little purring noises that she's doing on her own, she is just telling us she is a happy, happy, content crow.
Well, I want to thank Shondell Cotter, who is the Education and Behavior Curator for Bird TLC, and of course, Gertie, thank you for coming in as well. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll learn about media preservation with Summit Day Media and hear about some of their work. We're joined by Principal Bob Curtis Johnson and archivist Mike Martz. They both got their start with media production and switched gears later in their careers. We discuss what their work is like, their project digitizing and cataloging KYUK's tape archive, and more. Martz says their work is more than just saving old content for later.
The word preservation in technical terms is probably okay, but I think in terms of culture and language, maintenance is a better word, because you use preservation and the first image that comes to your mind usually is something in a jar on a shelf, something dead. And particularly here in Alaska, native languages and cultures aren't dead. They're very much alive. And so the preservation or maintenance is keeping them going to the future for the people themselves and for the broader world, wherever they can go.
Yeah, I really like that idea of maintenance. I'm going to have to keep that in mind when, you know, discussing stuff like this. I like that concept of it. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to just kind of what Summit Day Media does. So I guess maybe, Bob, can you maybe kind of just briefly describe what you do? And it sounds like it's maybe more than just preservation work.
Yeah, we do have a production component and a consulting component to what we do. We do have some large preservation projects going on nearly all the time from across Alaska, and we have had clients in 8 U.S. states over the years. And a lot of it is trying to streamline preservation process and digitization. We call it capture because we're capturing usually analog media, but sometimes digital. So it's not always digitization, because some of this is born digital media. Mm. We're already in that era where things that maybe were on DV tape or DAT tape or mini disc and that sort of stuff are originated in digital and still need to be brought basically into files to protect them.
Why does this stuff need to be preserved? I know you kind of talked about some of the reasonings, but, you know, why can't we just throw our old, like, family videotapes or audio tapes in a box in the shed and just call it good?
What I would say is obsolete carriers, obsolete playback machinery, and that is the biggest risk right now to anything. What a lot of folks think of, they think of film preservation and they think of a decaying asset. That's not really what we have the most problem with in video and audio tapes. It's not that the tapes themselves are falling apart so much. It's just the machinery is. Mm. And the electronics no longer work properly, and it's not safe to play them on that machinery anymore. And that's the real risk, and that's where the danger is and the time urgency of it is trying to migrate all this material off of its original carrier so that the content can be available for, as Mike said, cultural access right now, so that it can remain vital in the language, in the different cultural activities, dance, other things that are going on right now, because otherwise it's been removed. It's under the bed, in the box, and nobody can access it, you know, to speak. But so we're doing is getting it back out and available to people in the form that is most useful today and is the best preservation medium known right now for this kind of work.
Let's maybe talk about some of the process a little bit, and then we'll maybe talk about some more specific work. But, you know, you get some obsolete tech like video or audio tapes that, you know, somebody needs to preserve. What's maybe kind of generally the basic steps that you would go about saving or maintaining that stuff?
Right. You start with an assessment, what kind of condition it's in. Usually it's a visual assessment, because if you're talking about magnetic media, you can't see what's on it unless you play it, and you don't want to play it unless you're sure that the device you're going to play it in is in working order. And then usually find out any metadata you can from it, like a title, anything that happens to be on the, you know, on the medium itself, on the tape itself, say. And then from there, we would take and do an inventory into the database system. And then from there, selections would be made to get sent out to a lab to do the actual digitized work if it's analog material. Then they come back and we do a quality check on them and then figure out where they're going to be stored.
Yeah.
If it's a contract project, it may end up going to the North Slope or to Bethlehem, somewhere else, or it may stay in Summit Day's servers.
Yeah. What's the difficulty of maybe the like digitizing or the preservation process versus maybe the archival maintaining that kind of database? They're very important aspects, but I feel like, you know, it could be overwhelming, I guess.
It certainly is. And we work like 98% with businesses and nonprofits, archives and museums, and sometimes just organizations that want to protect their history. But it feels overwhelming to folks, you know, and it's easy to see why. It's just, where do you even start? And so we explain it. Everything gets a number right off the bat. That's the first thing. And if it's a big enough collection, then it gets a barcode so that we can more efficiently manage things in and out of the database. And you can always find out where something is. And then you build up a little catalog. It may be modest at first, but you'll have at least that unique identifier, that what we call a UMID. Then you've got some basic information about that tape. What is that? What's on? What do you think is on it? Because what's out on the label may not actually be what's on the tape. And that's, Mike pointed out that problem. A film is human readable. You can put it over a light box and you can see with your eyes exactly what is on that. And you can't hear the sound, but that's addressable. You can solve that. With a videotape or a digital file, it has to be able to be played in its original created, whatever device was made for that before you can be sure what's on it. Mm-hmm. And even if something's written on there, you can't be confident that that's the only thing on there or the most recent thing that was recorded on there.
Yeah, blank tape might have been re-recorded over multiple times.
And at the tail, as you know, if you put something shorter over something longer, sometimes what's written on the label is not very interesting, but you will put the tape up and then you'll find at the end something really interesting.
It's like the masterwork painting behind the other painting or something.
Exactly. Well, I have to say, just the fun of this, and you know, Mike will have experienced this multiple times, is it's sort of a treasure hunt aspect in like, what exciting discovery are we going to make today? What, you know, one unexpected content is going to rise up out of here and be just, you know, exciting and thrilling. And that's the value of that. And then also we get to hand that material back to our customers, our clients, and they get to thrill a discovery, but they get to also high grade that because they can scan the lists that we present them with and they can find the material that they want more easily.
Maybe let's dive into some of the specific work. So one of the big projects is digitizing KYUK's tape collection. That's the public broadcaster out of Bethel. So it sounds pretty large in scope. I think you said 7,500 pieces of tape or something like that. Could we talk about that and kind of what the project is and what it entails, I guess?
Well, that from the beginning, that was it. We were approaching a giant collection, and we had to get our arms around it first, working with the folks there in Bethel. And so Katie Basil has been a project coordinator from the beginning. Gabby Histan Salgado is our multimedia director there now, and she's been wonderful. And Shane, the general manager, is extremely supportive, and they've developed a local advisory board made up of all folks in the YK, but largely in Bethel, I think, that all the decisions go past those folks. And to make sure that we're going after and, you know, approaching the collection in a way that makes sense to them. And then the next big job was to just start figuring out what we were going to do and applying for grants to support that. And then along the way, they decided that they wanted to reclaim their studio where all the tapes were housed. And since we were doing most of the work here in Anchorage, it determined that the right move was to ship the entire collection into us for easier access to manage it and a little better storage environment, easier to maintain here in Anchorage than in Bethel.
What does a collection that size look like physically?
Piles and piles of video and audio tapes. But in this room, floor to ceiling.
Yeah, I mean, 10 feet high of boxes or something. Mm-hmm. That's wild.
Yeah, they weren't even in boxes. There were a lot of them that didn't even have a case.
Just loose and
just
floating.
Tapes on shelves
Oh, wow.
20 feet by 20 feet by 8 feet at least.
And what time frame are we kind of looking at from kind of when to when have you kind of found some of this stuff?
It goes back to the early days of when the station started, which was in 1971. Both audio and video back as far as the 70s and up to most recently, I'd say, in the early 2000s.
Mm. And what types of stuff is it? Is it just kind of the daily programs, whatever was getting broadcast? Or
I've always felt the core of the collection is the Yupik language material, particularly elders. And one of my late colleagues in the 80s started capturing that with people, and he called it Waves of Wisdom. So whenever news crews, the Yupik news crews would go out to do a story, they would also include trying to find an elder and record something, just let them speak whatever they wanted to speak about, whatever was on their minds. A lot of really valuable cultural information, you know, ways of living, how to live a proper life, how to raise children, hunting, survival skills. Could run, you know, they ran the gamut of things from people, and they captured a lot. And so from the beginning, that was the highest priority for me to have digitized was those. And there's several hundred.
But if people want to see these, there are a number of Waves of Wisdom materials up on American Archive.
The Archives of Public Broadcasting, are there. And Bob said they've told him and others that the KWK collection is the most heavily accessed that they have. So, and it's mostly people from the YK Delta, mostly people from that region. And they're listening to their grandparents.
Yeah, these are people they probably
or
know,
parents.
Grew up with.
Yeah, so that was always the highest priority for me. I was always the most worried about those particular tapes until we were able to get this project going.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of the type of thing where if one of those is lost, there's, you know, something
you've
lost
an entire encyclopedia.
Yeah. Let's see. So you also have an internship opportunity. Did you want to talk about that a
little
bit?
Sure. The Association of Moving Image Archivists, AMIA, has gotten a grant for a project that they have called Pathways, which is to seek interns to learn about moving image and sound archiving. And it's funded by the IMLS, the Institute of Museum and Library Services. So it's a paid internship. It'll run this summer. It starts in May, goes through 2.5 months, and it's on-site in Anchorage working with us 30 hours a week at Summit Day. And then we're co-hosting that with KYUK. So there'll be a week in Bethel for the intern to go out and see the station and work with the folks at the station to really understand what the collection is all about. But they'll be working specifically with the KYUK collection here in Summit Day.
Sounds like an awesome opportunity. Maybe I should do that.
Well, if you want to, you can go to summitdaymedia.com/apply.html, and you will find links to the Pathways program and application form there. Ammon, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. Well, you know, if anybody else out there too, I guess, if they want to apply, you know. That was my conversation with Summit Day Media's Bob Curtis Johnson and Mike Martz discussing their work as media preservationists. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's all for our show today. I'd like to thank the Bird TLC crew, Laura Atwood, Katie Thorman, John Dell Cotter, and Gertie the Crow. I'm Dave Waldron, and thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.